Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?"
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for downloading this episode of...
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads. Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Resound, I'm your host of All Episodes Irregular, Dennis Funk. So the other day, Third Coast hosted an event in Chicago called S-Town Hall, where we invited the public to come and discuss the big podcast of the moment, S-Town. We had a good bit of interest in making this conversation available later on, so for all of you, here it is. If you want to join in the discussion after you listen, we've made a Facebook group so you can chat and share your thoughts with other fans. For that, all you have to do is go to facebook.com/groups/S-Town Hall. That's S-Town Hall, all one word, no hyphen in the S-Town bit. I don't have a gavel, so I'll just call this meeting to order. Here is S-Town Hall.
Hi, everybody.
Hello, hello, hello. So, people have been coming up to us, and probably you too, and saying, what do you think of S-Town? So pretty spontaneously, I mean, we said we've got to bring people together and have this discussion. That is one of the things that we love to do at Third Coast.
Okay, so who here feels like S-Town was like the first podcast you really listened to? Round of applause.
You have to clap, yeah.
You got
to
clap. Oh my God, you guys are pros. Amazing. Okay, who's like a podcast expert? You listen to a bunch of stuff. Same.
So a little bit more housekeeping for tonight. Here are the things that are going to happen. We are going to pose questions and hear your answers. We are going to give you time actually to talk amongst yourselves. And at the very end, we're going to do, because this is S Town Hall, what we're going to do is give people a chance just to state your case. Okay, so I'm going to start by asking, it seems like such a simple question, but I think it actually is fairly complex, which is, what is S Town about? So someone says to you, what is S Town about? You say,
I think it's about one man's tortured being, one man's struggle to find what's unfolding in his life, what his life is all about, and all of these, the complexities that go along with all of us. I mean, it's about one guy, it's about all of us, all at the same time.
What, and it's about his tortured life.
A tortured life, but a complex life. Maybe tortured, he's tortured, but everybody's life adjacent to him is so complex and twisted as well.
Great.
Has anyone tried to describe this to a friend and just gotten stuck?
My friend asked if it was scary, and I had a hard time responding.
Clap if you think it's scary. No? Okay.
Has anyone had a really successful time describing it to somebody where, like, you described it and they're like, oh, I definitely want to listen? And if so, what did you say? We're asking because, I mean, it's been really hard for us to describe it to
clearly
people.
Clearly, it's hard. So, yeah. Now, what I tend to do is I don't want to give away that, okay, spoiler, there's going to be millions of spoiler alerts. Is anyone not finished? Okay.
Oh, Linda. Lawton.
Okay. There are many spoiler alerts, but you've probably gotten this
far. He has mercury poisoning.
You know that he commits suicide at the end of the second episode. So I don't want to give that away. So I say it's a story of a man who hates his town. That's where the name comes from. It's shit town. But that also represents how he feels about the whole world. So my description of it is really about John B. It's so much about John B. That raises a lot of questions for me because there's a lot of other people in the story. And I think that's where it gets really hard to explain what happens. So let's move on. Colleen.
People have asked me about this show. I talk about those things too, but the other thing I point out is the idea of, like, when you do pass away and the story that's, like, still left to tell about yourself and how his story gets told, and that doesn't often happen, right? So John B. could have left us and we wouldn't have, like, known all these things about him, and all these characters wouldn't have come together in the way that they did. And the fact that, like, his story was told makes it a really unique listen, and that's sort of how I get people to listen to it.
That's great.
Do you tell them that he dies?
Yeah. Only because, like, while that's a big, I mean, that's a huge thing that happens in the story, but really, like, maybe that's not what it's about, right? It's about this larger story that is him.
Okay. So you get to that's maybe that's not what it's about. That comes back to our question, what is it about?
Well, another way to describe it is in terms of form instead of content, that it's a delicate literary wolf in mystery true crime sheep's clothing.
I want to keep thinking about that. Let's keep thinking about that as we come back to that.
It's kind of like a eulogy. There's this, one of the important moments in it is when the preacher gives the eulogy for his life, and they're like, wait a minute, that's not what he's like at all. And then it seems like what we get in the remainder of the podcast is what should have been in the eulogy, in a sense, right?
I guess that's, yes. And I wonder where Rita comes into that. And we can talk about that maybe in other ways, because I don't see where she fits into that eulogy, particularly.
As in, you don't. Like the that's your you don't love that storyline, right?
I don't love that storyline. Okay. I'll admit it. But I feel like it that's where I get confused about what it's about, because where does the fight over his legacy of his just personal wealth that he may or may not have, where his trucks and tools, where does that fit into that?
Yeah.
So this feels a little more complicated than a eulogy, or feels like a very complicated eulogy. Through the eyes of a New York City producer named Brian Reed.
Eulogies would be better, I think. if they were more complicated.
So, oh, one more and then we'll move on.
So I'm sorry, I didn't have to hold that. So, I've heard this someplace that there's, you know, these like certain things that make a story, and one of those is Stranger Comes to Town. And so I feel like a lot of this is Brian Reed coming to town, and John B. has reached out to him to bring him into his world, and I think that's a big part of what happens here.
Mm-hmm. I like that. A Stranger Comes to Town. So one of the things, I mean, I just talk personally for me that propelled me through this program is that I fell pretty quickly for John B. I was kind of infatuated with him as a very complex, interesting, funny, surprising person. We want to play a little clip to bring him into the room.
Basically, I've got these kids out here digging a hole between the house and the yard in the summer, and we're going to plant some cast iron plants. That's Aspidistra elator, in case y'all don't know.
I don't know what either of the things you just said are, but that's
okay,
fine.
Okay, well, it's a scientific thing. That's a cast iron plant. You know how these kids talk on cell phones all day long? You can't get them to do nothing because they're on the cell phone. And they're tweeting, and they're YouTubing, and they're always on Facebook. I'm out there on the back porch. If you keep your mouth shut, you'd be surprised what you can learn. Because, you know, kids around here have grown up so destitute, they don't have enough sense to be ashamed of anything. They'll just tell everything.
Okay, so there's John B. I'd like to hear from other people when you fell for him or what about him captivated you, or maybe he didn't, and if so, why not?
I can't point to, in my mind, an exact moment, but I feel like he started kind of grandiose and in charge and running the show, and he knew everything, and he was all, to me, seemed like really right in his own mind all the time with what he was saying. These are the facts and this is the way the world works. And then it just started sort of to peel away these layers of perception or misunderstanding or truth or not true or that. And so he just became way more complicated and way more interesting, but yeah.
He sort of lost control. Like
when he started to lose control and sort of not have the, I'm bringing this reporter in and I'm going to, I guess, you know, it really started to fall apart really early when he's directing directing the search in the library, where he's like, oh, like, why do you give a shit about this? Like, don't, or like showing no interest when, you know, going to a library in this place in Alabama for this reason is pretty specific. So I don't know. It just seemed that got interesting.
Yeah.
I liked when he peed in the sink while he was on the phone. That was a moment I was like, oh, John B.
Yeah. Did anyone else have like a moment, a specific moment when they sort of decided that John B. was a special kind of guy? Mine was when he, yeah, particularly special. Mine was when he, like, in the first episode, in the first chapter, he's talking and he interrupts to eat Tums. And he's like, ugh, the cherry one would fall out right away. Does anyone else have a moment or just any reflection on John B.?
I think that I have known several people who remind me explicitly of John
really?
B. Indeed, indeed. Wow. And in ways good and bad. But that for me, I think that the fact that he has total recall of the Latin names of plants, but then he refers to it as Little Caesar's Pizza Hut. for me, that really cemented my relationship with him, that he is ultra specific in certain regards and completely oblivious to the world in others.
I don't know. I would have complicated or different feelings about John B. Initially, I mean, he's obviously so smart and charismatic and funny. And then in the middle, it seems like his mental illness became clear. I mean, I think he was probably manic depressive. And then at the end, it was really heartbreaking. The long conversation we had with his, not his lover, but his boyfriend or whatever from Charleston. I mean, that was like, I mean, I had a lot more compassion for him at the end.
So, let's talk about some of the other characters, though I'm sure we'll end up talking about Brian and
John for the most part, but because John B. dies, you know, commits suicide at the end of the second episode, there have to be other characters who, or we call them characters, which actually feels a little demeaning. I shouldn't even say that. Other people in the program who drive it forward as well for you, and who you care about or who interest you. And I wonder if there anybody wants to suggest someone else. You were talking
someone
about
someone who stood
Olin.
Out.
Yeah.
This is such a tiny character, and he doesn't necessarily drive it forward, but from a producer perspective, he was really interesting for me. The family member of Tyler who had the brain injury.
Uncle Jimmy.
Jimmy. Yeah. So he, for me, for as a radio producer, he was super interesting character because the producer had to acknowledge this thing that was happening in the background, but the thing that was happening in the background was great. Like it needed to keep, you know, like that tape was such good tape. But it, for me, it sort of also painted a picture of Tyler's family and maybe what that whole scene looked like, and having this guy there, and I thought, even though he was small and didn't necessarily like move the story forward in like a specific way, I thought he added quite a bit to it.
Yeah, he added so much humor. And at first I thought, oh, you know, yeah, he had to explain this because you hear the man sort of echoing, you know, what's going on in the foreground. And then I had a second thought, you know, Brian could have moved him away, but he didn't. So I think Brian actually liked having him there just for the reasons that you're talking about. Exactly.
We were struck also by these moments in the tape that don't necessarily move the story forward, but sort of add another layer of description and of imagery. So I think let's play. We have a clip that struck us as particularly literary, which is this word that's being used to describe the podcast. And then we'll see what you guys think about it.
Before we had clocks, we had sundials. And I never thought about this until I started talking to John, but watching a sundial, which could be as simple as a stick in the ground, as the shadow crept along, you were actually witnessing the rotation of the earth. It's so much less abstracted than a clock, a level closer to time itself. Anyway, John told me sundials often have mottos engraved on them. John says, tedious and brief is one. What do you mean? Tedious and
brief? Your life is tedious and brief. All sundial mottos are sad like that.
So a lot of the clock imagery, and it even starts the first episode, starts with the description of clocks before you even know what the series is going to be about. Really, really love that. And I don't know if you saw that we tweeted that we really recommend that you listen to the whole series, then you go back and you listen to the first one, now knowing what happens. But going back and listening to the description of the clock, I really, really love that. So there's a lot of this does not sound like a This American Life piece, even though it came from This American Life. It doesn't sound like the first or second season of Serial. So it'd be great to hear some of your thoughts about what they tried and
what was new and striking about this that you felt like you hadn't heard before.
So this is probably because like there's a lot of podcasts out there that use true crime, or I'm a big fan of like the Lore podcast, which deals with death a lot, but death is often used as like a way to frighten us or to give us history or to entertain us. But it's very, very rarely, at least in the podcast I am listening to, used to remind us of our own mortality and then to just kind of like force us to sit in there. And so I was just kind of struck that they really it was one of the most like honest portrayals of like what our lives are actually about, and okay making the listener uncomfortable with that. And you can tell that Brian's uncomfortable with that as well. I when I listened to that little segment last night when I was listening to the long form interview with Brian Reed, because I replayed that, and then I was listening to this again right now, and I just like felt uncomfortable thinking about death in a place that I don't, you know, normally think about death or that I try to escape it. And so just kind of seeing them take this device that is so used in the medium that we're using and then say like, no, we're going to come kind of subvert how we use death, and we're going to subvert, you know, the twist, right, is that it's not true crime, was really interesting to me.
Because you go into it thinking it's going to be true crime.
You hear, you know, just that description they gave, and then a death happens, and then there's a treasure hunt. Back this way.
This gets back to the scary comment, and it's not death that's scary in this story to me. It's the loneliness that John B. felt, and the isolation, not just of him, and just the I kept thinking over and over again, like, how many more John B.'s are there out there? There's millions. How many more Tylers are there out there? There's millions. I mean, as everything unfolded, I was struck by not how unusual this story is, but how probably common it is, especially when the one episode when he talks about loneliness and how many people really don't find that love. And I'm thinking, I think a lot of people or struggle to hold on to it or struggle to, you know, over the loss of it.
Yeah, and that's, and you feel like that was handled maybe in a different way in this podcast, or maybe something you don't hear on the radio or in podcasts?
You know, I think we hear it in fiction and not in true life often. Even the true crime dramas don't delve into that. I don't listen to a lot of true crime podcasts, but I've seen a lot of the, you know, documentaries on both public television and commercial television. It seems to be a genre that falls into a sort of predictable pattern. And it's just, yeah, they have these elements of them that are human and that we all can somewhat relate to, but not at this scale. The depth of the humanity of all the characters, I feel like, or most of the characters anyway, are striking and compelling in a lot of ways. At the same time, I'll be honest with you. A lot of it made me, as a journalist, uncomfortable. Like that I'm peering into something that's really not something that we should be, quote-unquote, reporting. That this is a human drama. This is an incredibly well-told story. But I don't know that it's, like, what we should be doing, you know?
Well, I mean,
that's
I think
a whole other issue, but,
yeah,
you know.
That, yeah, and I want to get to that. I mean, one thing that's different is, in a typical piece, Brian Reed would go down there, he would do his research, he would find that a murder didn't happen, he would think, well, you know, I'm glad I met John B., but that's the end of that story. I'm going to pack up my bags and go home. I'm not going to visit another, as it turns out, about 12 times after John's death. So that's a real departure, to think that there is a story after he finds out that there wasn't a murder.
I think the fact that they took novels as their inspiration, and they've been fairly explicit about saying that that was their inspiration, freed them from a lot of the conventions of even long-form narrative audio. Like this idea of signposting that you have to be really clear about where you're going and saying, trust us, we'll get there, and like here are some breadcrumbs we planted along the way. And I think they just really wanted to free themselves of those conventions. And so that's why they gave themselves license to tell this like sprawling, meandering story where they poked into some corners, and for me there wasn't necessarily payoff in all those corners, which frustrated me, the treasure hunt being probably one of the biggest ones, but other moments were really beautiful even if they were kind of self-contained, and that to me was really novel, not to make a pun out of it. And I think the closest thing I've heard to that would be that one Reply All episode where they just like kick around New York for a day, because that was also kind of an episode about nothing with very little payoff, except that you're just being asked to follow these guys along because you find them interesting in their own right. So that to me was like the only example I could think of where, you know, they had such freedom in the form.
Yeah. We would also, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that we've come to accept in radio. We've always done it this way. We want to tell people where they've been, where they are, and what's coming up. We're constantly sort of guiding. And that's because we assume, you know, you're kind of half listening. Or you space out for a minute because you are driving or you're doing something that requires part of your brain. And they decided that they weren't going to do that. And that gives this a really, really different sound. You actually have to pay attention, or you can go back and you can go re-listen because that's an option for you too. But it gives it a very different feel, and a feel that I personally really, really liked. And now never want to hear it again. never want to hear the hand-holding again, I should say. Mm. But
I was going to say something very related, which is I think that this podcast, for the first time, and especially in something like so long form, acknowledged that it's coming out of a literary tradition. It's coming out of a documentary tradition in a much more overt way than a lot of podcasts we hear, which seem to kind of feel like these immaculate new inventions. And so that was really exciting for me to hear them referring back to Southern Gothic literature and to be using novelistic language. I think they didn't go the full way there. And so when you guys say, like, you know, it didn't sound like This American Life, there were moments that didn't sound at all like This American Life. And then there were moments, I'm thinking of when we first get to know John and we're in the maze and he's so negative and he's amazing. Brian's like, wow, the maze, it's so green and beautiful. And John's like, global warming. And then we hear Brian come in as in this reporter mode being like, yep, he's very negative. Yep, there he goes again. And for me, like when I was listening to it, I wanted them to go kind of full on literary and novelistic and to kind of leave this reporter like commentary out of the way. And I think if we get to ethical questions later, which I'm sure we will, it is this tension between this kind of novelistic literary nonfiction style and journalistic reporting that asks a lot of the questions.
Super helpful.
So we're going to let you guys break up now into small groups. If you want to combine with like four or five people next to you, hopefully you don't know a couple of those people. You can talk about anything that we've talked about up to this point. I want to add just one more thing that you can discuss, which is like, what are the novels or sort of fiction things that this reminds you of, or that you want to recommend to other people now that they've listened to S-Town? Things that don't come from nonfiction journalism, but come from the fiction and literary worlds. So
this is an experiment.
Yeah.
We're going to give this a try.
Yeah.
It's going to go like about 8 to 10 minutes, and then we're going to try to get your attention back.
With a Rose for Emily. Is that what the song is called? Why can I never remember?
I think that's right.
You'll recognize the song.
Yeah. And cool. Let's go.
A few moments later.
The summer is here at last. The sky is overcast and
warm. Okay, it sounds like you guys like talking in groups, right? You're into it? Okay, I'm glad. I'm super glad because we hoped you'd like talking in groups. Is there anything that you really want to share from your group with the whole group? Something that came up that you were like, that's the best idea ever?
I think he definitely had mercury poisoning.
Okay, definitely mercury poisoning, for sure, for sure. Oh, by the way, also, we've tweeted a couple times with hashtag #STownHall. If you guys want to, you know, keep up the conversation on Twitter. Apparently, it was, like, being used before for, like, some conspiracy theory about Hillary Clinton's campaign. I don't really understand the hashtag. But just looked it up for the first time, and it, like, already exists. But we can, like, reclaim it as our own.
Yes.
No, just hashtag #STownHall. At Third Coast Fest. Okay, anything else you guys want to share? Did you learn? Oh, yeah, Eric.
Well, our group talked a lot about whether this is an ordinary story, the story that you would see in a lot of places, or whether it was an extraordinary story, whether there are, in fact, a lot of people like John B. in towns all over the place. Their eccentricities are different. They may not be the world's greatest clock repair person, but that you will find people like this. And one member of our group, where'd she go? she was talking about this. She used to work in a coffee shop and would see people coming in with all kinds of, with their own, either lonely people coming in, have these long Rococo stories to tell. And so the question is whether this is an ordinary story of ordinary people that we're getting a deep look at, or whether there's something extraordinary about S-Town.
That's something I was thinking about with all the friends that John had. I felt like he also befriended a lot of other people, or other people befriended him, who were very similar in that they had, you know, they were autodidacts, or they were just people who, they were self-taught, and they were interested in very particular things about the world and in conversation about it. And I imagine that some of those people also were fairly lonely outside of their relationship with John. I don't know if that rings true for anyone else.
I have to say that I was having lunch with my sweet, sweet barber. His name is Doug. He's like one of the sweetest humans. He grew up in rural Indiana. And the first thing, he listened to all of S-Town because I was like, you have to listen to it. I have to talk to someone about it. And he was saying he knows all these people. These people are very familiar to him. He was like, I know Tyler. I grew up with Tyler. Like, all these people exist in his life currently. And so he felt, I don't know, I don't know if very at home is the right thing to say by listening to the podcast, but it was familiar, and he felt like it was something that was really accurate in the depiction of the state and the city where John was from.
Yeah, I mean, people's reactions also, I don't know, or it says so much about, like, where you're from and what you've experienced in terms of people's strong reactions to it.
But we're saying there are all those people out there, and yet do we ever hear them on the radio or in podcasts? Maybe that's something else that this podcast did for us, or this story.
I can just say that was what I was thinking about saying when I was talking about how I described this podcast, is I think as a Northerner, like, hearing a story of the South, hearing a story of the rural South in a time when, in like, politically, I feel like everybody's talking about rural areas and everybody's talking about the South in a way that's like, we have to figure out how to relate to that. We have to figure out what that looks, you know, like, or like, people in cities are, I feel like, and my circles are having those conversations. It felt really relevant to just have this story that didn't even have to be about anything, that could just be about sharing an experience that doesn't get highlighted very often.
Yeah. And then, okay, so we have Brian, right? He's sort of our guide. He's distinctly Northerner. We're going to play a clip of him in the tattoo shop.
I'm chatting with a few guys in a tattoo parlor, all of whom have heard about the murder. Some are pretty sure they heard it from Kabram himself.
You may call him and ask him.
No, don't do that.
Up here.
Don't do that.
Well, I'm not a puss, dude. I don't give a fuck.
Apparently, I'm the puss, because I do not want the dudes I'm talking to call Kabram right now. Already, this tattoo shop does not feel like the safest place to walk into alone at night, trying to dig up info about a covered-up murder by a guy everyone seems to know, all of which are things I've just done. The last thing I want right now is for the alleged murderer to show up.
Reactions to that?
I think this whole crime thing was a red herring. I think he went down there and talked, spent months down there, and then the kid who supposedly killed the other kid was in the lumberyard the whole time. He could have saved himself 6 months and walked in the lumberyard and had the conversation with him, but he kept running away from, like, you know, running away from the story from the whether or not, you know, what happened that night at the bonfire. He kept running away from that. You know, he wasn't ready to hear the answer. So he drew it out unnecessarily.
Is that because he was enjoying, he felt like John had something for him, a story he wanted to tell, or why did he do that?
I mean, I think he wanted a hook, honestly. He wanted a hook for this whole thing. And, you know, when there really wasn't one, it was enough. I mean, John was enough, but he probably didn't know it yet.
Okay. So he was looking for the hook.
Yeah, I just, in response to, like, the, like, view of rural America, for me it felt like interesting, but also inherently consumptive, as, like, somebody who's living in an urban space, and, like, then I get to, like, come to this bar and talk about it. Like, there's something that feels weirdly consumptive and like objectifying of these people's lives. Just wanted to bring that up.
Yeah, let's go over here.
Him going there and letting us see these people and letting us hear about poverty and letting us hear about how they feel about race probably outweighs that.
So I think, I mean, I feel like we're really aware that he's a Northerner coming and telling the story. Is that something that's uncomfortable? Are Northerners allowed to tell stories of the South and vice versa? Is there, that's just sort of that outsider idea? Can outsiders come in and tell another, you know, culture's story?
I mean, and I wanted to go back to something that somebody said earlier. Somebody I know who used to work in alternative newsweeklies in D.C. said something about how nostalgic this was for him, because it was the way that alternative newsweeklies used to allow writers because they had money and there were profits and they paid writers to go down rabbit holes. They used to allow them the freedom to not know what the story was before they pursued the story. And so that was something that was really nice about this story. There were times when Brian kind of got in the way, and I agree that not asking Cabram the obvious question, or, you know, there were several times during the whole narrative when he should have jumped and didn't that made me really hate him.
Yeah. I mean, so, like, they had an incredible amount of time to make this podcast.
But overall,
yeah,
the value in the thing is, I think, that a lot of what people are responding to is that it wasn't predetermined. The meaning wasn't predetermined. The message wasn't.
Right.
Even, the story wasn't even. And he came up with an amazing story that, you know, granted, any one of us could find if we, like, poked the person sitting right next to us.
For, like, 5 years.
Or his or her aunt.
Yeah, so nothing was predetermined. Was there another hand?
Back there, yep.
Yeah. I'm also really bad at speaking in public. But one of the things that's been on my mind about this is that it's for me, it's not so much about, like, whether Brian has the right to tell this story or whether it's okay for someone from the North to go to the South and tell that story. It's about keeping in mind the assumptions that are brought to the story. So it's sort of, in ways, easy to see, like, Brian's framework. He telegraphs it. He says, like, I'm a Northerner. I'm from New York. But in this time right now, it's very easy, I think, for us to look at John B. I say us. I should speak about me. Like, as a liberal person, politically, it's easy to look at John B. and his hatred of this town and see it as a validation of some of the things that you sort of assume about Alabama. And it's, I think, easy to lose track of the way that this story validates those assumptions, that it's miserable for John because he's a queer, chronically ill, mentally ill person. And it's, yeah, as a liberally minded person, it's easy to identify with that and through that lens just sort of, like, skew that view of rural Alabama. And I think for, it's easy to be misled, I think, by how human the portrayal is of the rest of these people within that lens.
I mean, that is one of the things that I've heard, and I believe too, that Brian expresses a lot of empathy throughout for a lot of the characters, not just John.
Yeah.
And that is probably one of the loudest things, in a way, that I actually gives him so much credibility that he listens so well.
Right. And he's surprised by these events himself, right? So we have the next clip, to segue. It's after John B. has killed himself, and it's Brian. I mean, we hear him on tape sort of figuring out, or trying to figure out, being at a loss for, like, who he is to this story at this point.
I mean, I would like to come down and see you guys. I don't know. Like, you know, I don't know what's appropriate. I was slowly doing a story that involved John, and I got to know him and care about him and know you guys, and I'm not sure where that leaves me as, like, who am I to this situation?
Well, I mean,
you know, it's
I wouldn't, if you wasn't anything to this, I wouldn't have called.
So how do you guys think Brian handled this? What do you think of his decision?
I actually think this was the moment that made me hate Brian the most. Okay, I'm glad I'm not the only one. I just felt like he was kind of putting himself in the spotlight when clearly John B. meant a lot more to many of the other people in this town or in his family than Brian did. And maybe it was the editing or the fact that, of course, like, there's only two people in the phone call, one of them being Brian. But it felt like he kind of, like, interrupted this other person's grieving to say, like, but what about me? Like, what should I do? Instead of being there for this woman who had a very difficult job of informing all these random people that John had killed himself, he was like, tell me what I should do, instead of saying, what is it that you need me to do?
Mm.
That's how I felt.
Anyone else? Reactions to that? The person in the green?
So for me, Skylar in that moment was my best friend growing up. I grew up in Alabama, a small town. It was about 4,000 people. I grew up Southern Baptist. I moved up here about 4 years ago, did a complete 180. But that girl, like, when she said that and that happened, I just trusted her, and I felt like what was supposed to happen was happening, because he wasn't saying, like, oh, this is great for my story, can I come down? He was like, oh my God, like, I'm still processing, you've been talking, I don't even know what you've just said, I'm just so confused, I just responded to him 2 hours ago, and she was saying, we're all feeling it, and I wouldn't have called you. And, like, that is absolute truth. And, like, for him to be there for them and, like, be there with them. I know I heard him ask several times, like, is it okay if we're recording? Or he would even say, like, I asked if it was okay. And so I don't feel like he disrespected them. I feel like I'm really glad that she called him and told him that, where she could have just said, well, he's just some New York guy, some Yankee reporter. What is he, you know? But she really recognized that he was involved in, you know, their lives enough to get that story and, like, hear about some really intimate details of their lives and see them on the day-to-day. The whole thing just felt really real to me, really special.
Does that mean you feel like Brian probably did build those bridges even in that one visit there?
Well, for me, it's like he said, it's not a friendship, because a friendship would go two ways, and John was too self-absorbed. Like, nobody really asked, you know, Brian about himself. But they welcomed him in, and that's what I saw growing up in the South, was like, if you show up at the door, all right, well, come on in. We got some dumplings over here, you know, help yourself. We don't even know your freaking name, but, like, you're a person who's at my house, so your family, come on in, take your shoes off, whatever. That was how they were with him. So it's a different dynamic than I feel like sometimes it can be in more different, whatever, economic areas, places, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, optional question for radio producers in the world. Like, have you ever been in a situation where you become friends with your subjects and you're not sure what to do with it? Moving on from that too, I mean, you can answer if you want.
This is sort of has to do with that. But so what you're saying is really interesting, because as a radio producer, like, if, and maybe this is too much in the sausage. Is that what people say?
Sausage factory.
Yeah, I don't know. But it was 100% necessary for our producer to have that tape of his connection in the South welcoming him in order for us to, like, as listeners, to, like, buy into the rest of the story. Otherwise, it would be too much of a what is he doing there type thing. We needed to hear, like, that side saying, come into our door. And I think about that in other ways. The A's hat, I think the point about the first episode where he's, like, keeps not wanting to do it and he could get it over with, I question now if that was, like, a structural choice that he made as a producer, rather than, like, because at the end of the day he had, like, hundreds of hours of tape, and, like, we are hearing, like, very specific amounts of that tape, and so keeping that in mind too, like, while listening to it, right, it's like it's a version of a reality that happened.
Yeah. So this turning point where he decides that he's going to actually, after John's death, go down back to Alabama another, like, dozen times. How do people feel about sort of that decision at that point? That, what do you think he was thinking at that time? And how do you feel about the choices that he made sort of from there on out?
I guess I'll talk about it from the opposite point of view, as a journalist who does just mostly short public radio stories, news oriented. I'm thinking of all the times I've let people like that just go. I don't have that kind of time to revisit people. I've done a lot of reporting in the South, particularly after Katrina and after the oil disaster in the Gulf. I've gotten to know a fair number of people that I have, some people I have revisited in places like Pearlington, Mississippi, and Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. I was thinking of a story I did the first Christmas after Katrina. We did a series of stories on what does home for the holidays mean when you have no home, and visiting people in trailers and in tent cities and things like that. And this woman who I just randomly knocked on the door of their trailer a couple of days before Christmas. And that Southern hospitality, I mean, people, even in broken times and even in like these incredibly tragic situations, feel not just, almost like an obligation in the South to talk to you, to welcome you. They all know somebody. Every person I talked to in the South knew somebody who had it worse than them, even if they lost family members, even if they had lost everything that they owned, that they knew somebody else down the street that they're much worse than my... There's something about that Southernness that I really am glad that Brian, like, let that unfold and let us kind of see that open up in and some of the people. This was a woman, though, that it was like, well, you're coming back for Christmas dinner, aren't you? In her trailer. And I'm like, you know, this is 2 or 3 days before Christmas. And I'm like, no, I think I'll be home. But it's just the way I think it is something that we need. One of the things I did like about it is that it kind of opened this world in a more intimate way than we normally see, particularly in news broadcasts. So.
Yeah. That makes me, sorry.
I just want to know if anybody else sort of wanted to weigh in on this discussion.
So I felt like the story was continuing because Brian was being an advocate for Tyler. You know, the cousins were this nemesis, and it felt like at that point he was reporting to figure out how he could make things best for Tyler. Like that was his role, maybe honoring John.
That was Brian's role. Sort of taking over for John B. in a way.
Yeah. This is also just reminding me that at the beginning I was like, we don't know anything about Brian. What's his personality? And then, I mean, we've sort of said this, like, we really experience him in his relationships, the way he relates to other people. But I think let's get into even murkier territory, trickier territory, and then we're going to break up again into small groups and let you talk some more about everything that has been filling up this part of the conversation. So this is a clip when Brian is describing why he's sharing something that John told him off the record. And we just noticed this was like the time that he sort of most justified his decision on tape. So here it is.
This is going to sound like a ridiculous question, but is there a gay scene down here?
Oh, my God. There's no telling how many closet cases are in this town. You turn that off and I'll tell you something. Hit the kill button for a second.
This is one of the few times John ever asked me to turn my recorder off. What that usually means is that I wouldn't tell you what he said without getting his permission to describe it. But there are a few reasons I am going to give you an overview of what he told me in the car that day. First, since John died, two other people who knew him well have told me the same information on the record. Also, John was very clear that he did not believe in God or an afterlife. So John, in his own view, is worm dirt now, unaffected by this. And lastly, what John disclosed, and where it led me after he died, it helped me understand him so much more. And I think trying to understand another person is a worthwhile thing to do.
Okay, we're going to leave it there, and you can go back into the groups you had before, different groups, whatever you want to do. You have another 10 minutes till the song begins.
Later.
I'm so glad that you guys have so much to talk about in your groups. Yes, that's awesome. We're gonna like wrap it up all together, and then you can talk some more and meet even more people that you don't know yet and talk about audio and do all that nerdy stuff.
So we did that voting beforehand, who is the protagonist. I don't know if anybody would want to change their votes after the conversations, but Ariel has done the tally and can let us know.
Okay, so overwhelming vote for John B. John B. Yeah, round of applause for John B. Second place, Brian Reed. And I don't know about you, but I love the sound of a man crying, so that was some of my favorite tape as well. Third place was The Town. And we got some very... Yay, The Town. It exists. And we got some interesting write-ins. One was The Maze, which is maybe a nice metaphor for the entire podcast. One was Tyler, Sweet Tyler. One was Mary Grace, Sweet Mary Grace. One was just podcasts. Because we're all winners. And my absolute favorite was a write-in for Loss and Regret. So there we go.
You're reading those made me think about what I loved about the series, and I'm a critic, so I'm always going to find things I wish could be different or better or whatever. But just so glad that this was made and that I got to know the people in the series in S-Town. So we want to wrap things up by talking about, you know, the ending and how you feel about the characters at the end, all the people we talked about and some that we haven't. But how do you feel like it wrapped up? How do you feel like it ended? In that last episode, we hear that he might have had mercury poisoning. We hear that he's been self-harming. And we hear that
I think what was his great-grandfather is someone who came across, you know, who came by the land that they now live on in maybe not the most legit way, and that he is actually, his middle name is named for his grandfather. So wondering how people feel about how we wrapped up, all the places we went, and then where we ended, that what you were left with, and how you felt maybe, for instance, about Tyler at the end. So, thoughts? Anyone?
I just want to add a question, which is kind of the reason why I came, which is, who has the gold?
I'm so glad you asked that question.
Agreed. We're also,
what do people think about that? Do they care about the gold?
More questions? That's a great question too for the moment that you guys are encouraged to come up here and like speak your piece into this microphone too. But yeah, no. Do you have another question, Dad?
So there's this moment at the end when he seems to like, he's asking Tyler, you know, if you ever find it, think about telling me. But there's this really long pause that makes me, I mean, it kind of made me think about the, you know, his choice to tell the stuff about his sexuality that was off the record. I don't know. It just was like kind of setting something up that was outside of the room. That I just wanted, I don't know. It made me wonder, is he going to come back and tell us about the gold, or is he just like asking us to think about this?
Did you care about the gold?
I'd kind of gotten over it at that point, but then I was wondering why it was there again.
Yeah, we have to fill in some holes, I think.
Well, one of the thoughts is that he committed suicide because he had actually run out of money. I don't know. That's maybe at the rumor stage, but.
Right at the end, when he reads from his suicide note, and the suicide had happened, what, a year and a half or 2 years before the conclusion of the podcast, and it actually made me very conscious of the fact that this entire documentary was a podcast was really structured, and he was withholding things and telling you things, and that this, it was not, I mean, you had a feeling like it was just kind of unspooling as it went along, and he was kind of doing it on the fly, but that made me realize that there's artifice to this, and that, I'm not saying that in a bad way, but that he did construct this, and that was a very powerful ending, but he must have read that letter 2 years before he actually got to it in the story.
Did you like where it came up at the end?
It was a very powerful ending, but it made me really conscious of the fact that he had been withholding things from us all along.
Well, just to add what Eric is saying, I wonder at what point he realized, Brian, that this was not what he set out to find. I mean, he kept going back after finding that the murder wasn't a murder, and then we think, oh, it's all about this property fight, like, does Tyler get what he should get if he really does deserve it? Does the cousin get it? You know, like, is that what this is about, a fight over money? And all this kind of the way it unfolds, I too was like, oh, that was a ruse too. Okay. But I wonder at what point and how many times he went through different variations of this. This is the producer in me thinking about, like, when did he come up with what he came up with? You know, like at what point did he realize, oh, this is what I've got?
Well, it was a big group effort.
Yeah, I know that. How many times this probably went through edits and just changes, and the structure changed too.
I guess maybe there's a picture of it somewhere, maybe because long form interviewed Brian, but they worked with Post-it notes and they rejiggered exactly how this project would unfold in many, many, many different ways before they settled. Anything else about where you feel at the end of the story, or and you know where it leaves you in that last episode? One of the things that I felt like is that, I mean, some people said that the town was the one of the was a protagonist. I really felt like I knew some of the people in the town, but I never had a picture of the town. Like, I wanted to know the town better. You're disagreeing or agreeing? No.
I'm completely agreeing with you, Joanna. I think that that there is so much of scene painting that goes on. You know, I know exactly what that what the maze looks like, but I don't have any idea as to what the surrounding area is. That much was not filled in for me as a listener. And I think that that is a failing on the part of the producers to, you know, I mean, because we know that there is a lumber yard. We know that there is a fairly racially charged tattoo parlor / bar in another town over. That's one of the things that seems to get glossed over. It's not in Woodstock. Thank you very much. See, again, the main setting of the show. So
yeah. And there's a trailer park across from where John lives. But yeah. Do you want to? Okay. So if we want to. If there are any more comments that kind of to address that question about where we end up, if not, we can do this. We can try this other thing, this other experiment. The last one went so well. We're ready for another one. People in living up to the name of this town hall, if people just want to have an opportunity to talk about whatever you want to talk about that has to do with this town, we welcome you at this point to do that. Who is going to be the first brave soul?
Okay, 30 seconds.
Okay. Listening to the show, I was taken back to the audio documentary Ghetto Life 101 that was produced here in Chicago. And I think that there is so much power in long-form audio documentary, especially telling the stories of lives that we don't come into contact on a day-to-day basis. And I really want to express this or impress upon you that you should go and check out all of the beautiful work that's been done in the corpus of recorded long-form narrative storytelling. And that's that.
Damn. That was amazing. We didn't hire him, but like we would have hired him to say that.
Yeah, I was going to say, go to thirdcoastfestival.org to find Ghetto Life 101 and so much more.
I can't raise this, but does anyone else want to make a point? Is there anything that we missed tonight?
Yes.
Yeah, go for it. Go for it.
We missed a lot. We missed so many things.
I had just one thing that I thought of based on what you just said. I thought of Ghetto Life 101, and I also thought of Our America, which was another documentary. And I also just kind of wondered, like, what would have happened if instead of Brian doing the story, they would have handed the recorders to the people who lived there and had them shape this a little bit more. I felt a little like that line to me was fuzzy about who was in charge. But I know that a narrative should be shaped by the person who's creating it. So anyway, it just kind of brought up all these questions and made me feel a bunch of strong emotions that were conflicting. That's it.
Great. Thank you.
That was a perfect 30 seconds.
That was...
Yeah. So a question I had coming in to this had to do with whether anybody interacting with John B. could have saved him from killing himself. And so, because there's so many times in the stories where somebody says, well, I just talked to him, and I just felt like, could somebody have connected? And I know, you know, that's what I was hoping for, and I was wondering if anyone had regret, anybody in the story, Brian maybe in particular, had any regrets for things that weren't said or that could have been said to have saved him.
Thank you.
So these questions about journalistic ethics took me back to Janet Malcolm's book, The Journalist and the Murderer. So I just want to leave you with the first line from that book, which is something like, every journalist who's not too stupid or full of himself to know what's going on knows that what he does is morally indefensible. Which I say not to condemn Brian, but to let him a little bit off the hook, mm-hmm. right? Because if he's a little bit ethically suspect, all journalists are. Thanks.
Thank you.
Followed up by a journalist. Yeah, so I'm not going to even get into that, but Shittown obviously wasn't Woodstock. To me, it was John B.'s Shittown. What he lived in was the Shittown, and which got me in the entire, from the end of the second episode on, got me thinking about suicide. Suicide affects so many people and is so, it's just not talked about, and the reasons for it and the people banging their heads against the wall trying to figure out why, what could I have done to stop it? And so I will leave you all with this. I've known some people who have struggled as survivors of suicide, that they, not that they've tried it and survived, but they've are the ones who have to live their lives after someone close to them have committed suicide. And there is an organization called Alliance of Hope, AllianceofHope.org, I think it is, or AOH.org, that I'm not, as a journalist, not crazy about promoting organizations, but a friend of mine and her mother run this after her brother was took his own life. And there are resources out there. Just that's my point. And that one of the things I liked about this story was, without saying so directly, it addressed that nasty mess that's left when someone takes their own life. No matter how many people they think that they don't affect, that they affect so many lives. And they're all left with these crazy questions. So to me, the number two character was suicide.
Okay, so what really struck a chord with me was when Brian kept stopping John and saying, like, wait, why do you have to kill yourself? And he says, I'm just tired in a way that I cannot put into words. Because I felt that way, and it made me think about what more I can do or what more we can do for each other to help each other out when it's not okay to talk about being depressed and it's not okay to talk about wanting to kill yourself. So how do we know if someone near us is actually going through that? Like, really, I'm just tired. I just don't want to be anymore. I'm tired. Like, how can we help each other? How can we lift each other up? Just, you know, quit being petty, basically.
Anybody else? This is getting super touching and, like, personal. Yeah. I don't want it to end. Yeah.
Well, let's keep the party going.
Okay.
The line that stood out most to me, and you played it on the tape before, was something along the lines of, what's so wrong about wanting to get to know somebody else? And the whole story to me was getting to know John and understanding who he was and where he comes from and how different he must have felt, as I know a lot of people express their sentiment of being city dwellers and not understanding what it's like somebody living in a rural area. And just about how many people we might come across, whether it's here tonight or within the course of our own lives, how well do we really know them? And do we understand them as well as Brian came to understand John throughout the course of the story? So just a good way to be introspective for ourselves to ask the question, do we know people that we interact with every day, whether it's our siblings, our coworkers, our spouses, and to just try and dig a little bit deeper and understand what everybody around us is going through every day.
I think we'll wrap it up there unless anyone else wants to get up to the mic for the town hall, part of the town hall. Thank you so much for everyone coming. A lot of people don't know one another here, and this was a really nice time for us, and I hope a cathartic time for everyone. We have one more clip we wanted to play.
Here's the last moment of
Bibb County, Alabama, came into its own as a thriving coal county in the late 1800s. Though the boom times wouldn't last long, in the 1890s, with the population on the rise, the citizens of Bibb started taking advantage of each other, stealing from each other, murdering each other, burning each other's houses down. It got so bad, a newspaper called the county Bloody Bibb, and the name stuck. Bloody Bibb, the 1890s version of Shittown. In 1891, one of the main perpetrators of this chaos, the most notorious gangster in the county, Jesse Miller, who extorted lots of land for himself and stole his neighbor's cattle and cotton, and whose gang killed people who knew too much, was finally locked in jail, but then escaped and fled Bibb County for good, signing over control of all his land in the county to his son, Brooks. Years later, Brooks took a 124-acre parcel of the family land and transferred ownership of it to his daughter, Mary Grace. Years after that, in 1965, Mary Grace, pregnant, began a ritual of sitting on that land and rubbing her stomach and pleading to God, saying, "Please, Lord, give me a genius. Lord, please, just make my child a genius." On March 15th, 1966, she had a red-haired boy, gave him a middle name after her father, Brooks, and brought him home to the 124 acres, to an old house with three chimneys in the middle of the woods.
Okay, so it's kind of crazy that we all just listened to the end of S-Town together because, I mean, I know I spent like, what was that, 7 hours listening to it by myself. Thank you guys for coming. Tomorrow we're going to send you all a link to a Facebook page called S-Town Hall where we can keep talking. We're going to open it up to people that weren't here at this event too. And then we can keep talking about all the things of S-Town. There's so much. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you all. The summer is here at last. The sky is overcast and no one brings a rose for Emily. She watches her flowers grow.